My name is Katie Turner. I'm the Education and Programming Coordinator here at Crossing Israel. Today's topic is Case Studies in Proactive and Crisis Medicaid Planning, hosted by Jim Wolverton, our Director of Legal Education here at Crossing Israel. First, I have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. Actually, it's in the chat. I don't know what to look at. We were having some issues with the handouts bar, but the chat should lead you to a Dropbox link that has all of the handouts for today. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screen at the end of the presentation, as this is a CLE requirement in order for you to receive your certificate of attendance. And now, let's get to today's presentation. Jim, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks so much, Katie. We were literally up till the moment of going live trying to figure out how to get the materials out. So those are underneath the chat feature. It'll take you to a Dropbox link, and you should see the PowerPoint, and then we created PDFs for the case studies that we'll go over. You don't necessarily need them for the program today, but as you're reviewing your notes and going through them, we thought those would be helpful for you. They're also available through our attorney access platform. And if you are new to this or want to see some other case studies, we do have those under our attorney access platform as well. So lots of places to get the materials, but for today, we're going to use the chat. This program today is really going to be a very quick run through Medicaid rules, and then we're going to get into case studies. So there's a lot to get through. I probably bit off more than I should have with this particular webinar, but hopefully you all will find it helpful in kind of seeing how clients can benefit from Medicaid planning. That's really what I want you to walk away with today. So if you are new, this is your first webinar, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. I do want to tell you a little bit about Krauss Financial. We are an attorney-led firm that provides asset preservation solutions for estate planning and elder law attorneys and their clients. And we use specialized insurance products, resources, and support, and we help attorneys streamline the process of advising clients planning for long-term care. We've been in this space for more than 30 years. We have a great collection of professionals on staff. And as far as the annuity solution goes, we handle over 400 cases a month. So our planners have seen a lot of these fact patterns and case studies that have come through. And that's really where we get a lot of the facts for the case studies that we do. We also provide solutions through long-term care insurance. And that is another product that I will talk to when we talk about proactive planning when we get to that part of the program. So Medicaid compliant annuities, funeral expense trusts, and long-term care insurance are really the products that we'll kind of be featuring during our case studies. So again, I kind of talked about the goals. We're going to cruise through the qualification and transfer rules really fast. So if this is all new to you, don't worry. We have a lot of resources around the qualification and transfer rules within our attorney access platform. So I'm going to go through it really quick. Don't worry. We have a lot of resources to kind of back that up. What I really want to get into is the strategies, the goals of those strategies, and then illustrate some really simple case studies. Again, these are not state specific, so there is going to be nuance when you get into your state rules and things like that. But these are really high level, how to approach these cases from a real basic standpoint and what these strategies mean. And again, the walk away, hopefully for you all, is have a light bulb moment that says, oh my goodness, I understand how I can help my clients that are in these types of situations. Okay, so buckle up. We're going to go fast today. I apologize. But again, I think there's a lot of good material in here, and it can really help illustrate how you can help your clients in these situations. So we're going to start off with the Medicaid program and the qualification rules. Again, from a really high level, not state specific. I would encourage you to log on to Attorney Access if you haven't already, get that free account, and get your state numbers at least from the desk reference guide. Because I'm going to go through some of these numbers, and you're probably going to be questioning, well, what are my state numbers? And that's where you'll find those, is on that state reference guide. So the non-financial requirements to qualify for Medicaid are pretty straightforward, be a U.S. citizen or qualified non-citizen. A lot of people are probably wondering, what did H.R. 1 do to these rules? I do refuse to call it by any other name. I'm sorry. and it did tighten up some of these U.S. citizen or non-qualified citizens. A lot of those rules will go into effect January 1st of 2027. So the folks that passed that bill were so proud of their bill that they didn't have it go into effect until after the midterm. So when, you know, work requirements, things like that, that didn't really affect long-term care Medicaid, but there were some citizenship and qualified non-citizen requirements that will be going into effect the beginning of 2027. They're a little tighter than they have been traditionally. The person needs to be age 65 or older, blind or disabled, and reside in a Medicaid-approved facility. What we're talking about here with traditional long-term care Medicaid is living in a skilled nursing home that accepts Medicaid dollars. So again, not every nursing home does accept Medicaid dollars, but the person does need to be in a Medicaid-approved facility. And again, that's usually a nursing home that provides that skilled nursing home. There are other programs for home health care, assisted living, but they have a whole different set of qualification rules. So these are folks that are living in the nursing home. Where the rubber really hits the road for most folks is the financial requirements. When I was learning this, I would get these two confused every single time I watched a webinar. And then finally, the attorney said, no, think of them as two completely separate categories of rules. We have income on one side, we have assets on the other. There's specific rules for each of them. And generally, either is belonging to the Medicaid applicant is either going to fall on one side of the wall or the other. So generally, something cannot be considered both income and assets. So we're going to attack these separately because I think it makes a little bit more sense. So we'll start with income. So this is the person's income that's coming in every month. We're going to talk about the institutionalized individual. That's the person who's living in that Medicaid-approved facility, that nursing home. And in most states, that institutionalized person, the person living in the nursing home, it's one of these key rules of Medicaid, their income from all earned and unearned sources must be less than the private pay rate of the facility. And generally, this isn't a problem. The average cost of a private pay rate in a facility in 2024, according to Genworth, was almost $10,000 a month. So generally, if someone has $10,000 of income every month, they're not looking for Medicaid benefits. But when we go to planning for helping people pay that $10,000 a month bill, we want to remember they want to keep their income below that private pay rate. In some states, you will have what's called a qualified income trust requirement or a Miller trust requirement if the person's income for 2025 is over $2,901 per month, then they will have to create a qualified income trust. This is not something that the attorney generally has to draft, but it's a form that the state provides, and it's just an extra step that the money needs to flow from the institutionalized person's account through the qualified income trust account and over to the nursing home with their copay. So just be aware that might be an extra requirement that's out there. So another key component to understanding the Medicaid program and where this money is flowing as far as income goes is the institutionalized individual's copay. Their contribution is the portion of their income minus a couple deductions. So remember, the institutionalized person's income is going to go to the nursing home as their copay, but there might be a couple deductions. The personal needs allowance is one. That's generally just a small amount of money to pay for magazines, haircuts, candy for Halloween, not a whole lot of things. That usually ranges, again, look at your state numbers, usually between $35 and $100, somewhere in there that the person can keep. So not all their income is going to the nursing home, but they can keep a little bit. Certain medical expenses, insurance premiums. We don't want insurance to lack. We want them to continue to pay, you know, their Medicare premiums. And then if we have a situation where we have a married couple and the spouse that's still at home, which we refer to as a community spouse, doesn't have much income, we want to make sure they can pay their bills. And we call that a diversion of income or an income shift under the monthly maintenance needs allowance rule. So again, this is a exception to the main rule. The institutionalized individual's income is going to go to the nursing home minus a few deductions, personal needs allowance, insurance premiums. And if there's a spouse at home that needs help paying the bills, we're going to move some of the money over there so we don't leave them impoverished. Other than that's kind of the rule, the money's going to go to the nursing home minus those deductions. Okay, so what about the community spouse, the person living in the home? What are the income requirements around them? Star, highlight this rule because we're going to use it when we get to the case studies. There are no limits on the income of the community spouse. So the community spouse could have an unlimited amount of income, and still the institutionalized spouse can qualify for benefit. So when we're thinking about income, we're thinking about the two different parties in that marriage, and the community spouse can have unlimited income. The way that I've heard a lot of attorneys explain this is there's no ceiling to the community spouse's income. Now, there's a floor. We talked about that. That floor is that minimum monthly maintenance needs allowance. They may be entitled to some of the institutionalized spouse's income, and you could shift that over. But the one we're really going to focus on here, not get too far in the weeds on this, is that there are no limits to the income of the community spouse. Community spouse can have unlimited income. There is no ceiling, but there is a floor. Okay, so you guys are all experts in income now. Again, I told you we were going to go quick just so we can get some of these concepts down and get into the case studies. Okay, so that's the income side of the equation, real high-level overview of the income rules. The asset rules are the stuff that the client has. So the institutionalized individual, person living in the nursing home, in most states is allowed to keep $2,000 of countable assets. So there's some defined terms there. We're going to talk about what a countable asset is, but they generally need to be below $2,000. So they're not going to have much money. What we've seen over the last couple of years is states have been increasing that number, that individual resource allowance above 2,000. California was the grandest experiment we ever saw at the beginning of 2024. They said, we're done with asset limits. You could be a billionaire and still qualify for Medi-Cal so long as your income was below the certain threshold. You can imagine how that went. They redid their budget this year and they said, we're bringing back the asset limit. So currently in 2025, there is no asset limit. There will be one coming back in 2026. I believe it's around $130,000. So it's still very high, but there will be an asset limit back in California. Then you can see Connecticut below $2,000. So Connecticut, they already had their rules in place and the federal rules came out. So they were allowed to keep and grandfather in their individual resource allowance, which is below 2,000. And you can kind of see where the rest have kind of fallen in by increasing those numbers. The most recent state that did that was Michigan. So Michigan moved theirs up to 9,660 this year. But for the most part, we'll use 2,000 unless there are some exceptions. And again, you can get these numbers through attorney access off your desk reference sheet. So that's the person living in the nursing home. They have an individual resource allowance, generally 2,000 unless the state has increased it. Now the community spouse has their own allowance amount, and that's called the community spouse resource allowance. And that's the total accountable assets we attribute to the community spouse. One way to think about this when you're thinking about Medicaid planning is the community spouse and the institutionalized spouse are considered as one unit. So it doesn't matter who's on title, and this drove me crazy as a former real estate attorney, but it's just the way that the rules are. No matter how it's titled, it's going to be counted by the couple as a unit. So what a lot of attorneys will do is they'll do intraspousal transactions before they submit a Medicaid application. So it's very clear who's on what title and kind of clean that up. There is kind of a buffer zone. In most states, they'll give you 90 days to 6 months to kind of clean that up. But most attorneys that do Medicaid planning try to do that before they make any application. So there's kind of two ways that states determine what is going to be the community spouse resource allowance. What amount can the community spouse keep? If you look at your desk reference guide sheet, sometimes you'll see two numbers. Those numbers this year are $31,584 as the minimum, and then the maximum CSRA is currently $157,920. Those numbers go up because of the inflation. The inflation's been going up, so those numbers have been going up each year. And so if you see those two numbers, basically what the rule is, you take the assets of the family, divide it in half, and if the number that you divided in half falls within that range, that's going to be your CSRA. If it's below that number, let's say they own $50,000 worth of assets, and it's $25,000, you divide it in half, you're below the minimum. The minimum is going to be your CSRA. If you have $400,000 of assets as a couple, that's going to be $200,000 once we divide it in half. That means the maximum will be the maximum. So you can never go above $157,920 for a CSRA. So that's how much the community spouse is able to keep. And then any assets over that amount, we have to figure out what to do with if we're in crisis planning. Hopefully you just have one number. That makes it a lot easier. When you look at your sheet and you just have the one number, some states will just recognize that standard number, and it's usually the maximum for that year. So this year it's $157,920. In most states, the pick just do the one number. So hopefully you just have the one. You have to do that math. but that's how the CSRA is calculated. So you have the individual resource allowance, you have the community spouse resource allowance. Anything above, any countable assets above that amount would disqualify that person from receiving Medicaid benefits to help pay for their nursing home care. Here's a nice map. If you weren't able to pull up those numbers for your state, you can see if you're in a gray state, that means you're lucky, you only have to deal with one number. If you're in a green state, you have to take the assets, the couple of assets, divide them in half, and see if they fall within that range and where they fall. So one of those terms was countable assets. So what's countable and non-countable is obviously really important when you're trying to determine if someone can qualify for Medicaid. Let's start with the easy rule. The countable assets are basically explained as anything the person can go liquidate, pay for their own nursing home bill, we're going to count, unless it's specifically exempt. So that's going to be checking, savings, other bank accounts they can liquidate, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, deferred annuities. Yeah, you might take a tax hit, but you can still liquidate them and go get those assets and pay for your own nursing home. So they're going to be countable assets. Other real estate and vehicles that are above those that are exempted, those are also going to be countable. So most things are going to be countable. So you have to put those assets, add them up, and see if it makes a person unable to qualify for Medicaid. Now, there are exempt assets per the federal rules, and then states are able to interpret those rules in different ways. So the first one is the primary residence. That's obviously the most important one. That, as a general rule, will be an exempt asset. Now, states have created their own rules around what it means to be an exempt primary resident. You have to have what's called an intent to return home, and different Medicaid manuals for different states define intent to return home differently. Some states, the most strict states, say, well, you have to have a doctor's note that says you can actually go home, or if you don't go home within 6 months, we're going to say you can't go home. So in those states, the primary resident might not be exempt for longer than 6 months. In other states, they'll say, well, if you have a subjective intent to get home before you pass away, well, then we're going to exempt the primary resident. So that's just a checkbox on the Medicaid application. Yeah, of course I want to go home. I don't want to live the rest of my days in a nursing home. I like to go home. So that home is exempt. So you do have to know kind of where on that paradigm your state lies. Generally, there's one vehicle as an exempt asset. So if the couple has two vehicles, they generally exempt the one that's valued more and then exempt the one that's valued less, and then count the one that's valued less. Personal and household items tend to be exempt. So you have to go through the house and do like a whole inventory unless you have collectibles with titles and things like that. Whole life insurance policies are exempt so long as they're under $1,500 face value. Again, those aren't usually the case, but if you do have folks that have life insurance policies, again, it's not ideal to cash them out, but the cash value of those life insurance policies is generally a countable resource. And then an exempt asset is a funeral expense trust. Again, that's a product that we sell here at Krauss. And what those are also referred to as irrevocable funeral contracts. And those allow families to pay funeral and burial expenses in advance, so you don't end up having to figure that out when someone passes away. IRAs are obviously a big consideration when we're talking about folks that are going to nursing homes and are living off of retirement income. Really, kind of the general rule for IRAs is they're going to be countable unless they're exempt. So if you look at the yellow states, the IRAs of both spouses are countable, so you have to figure out what to do with those. If you're in a gray state, the IRAs of the community spouse are exempt. So if the community spouse has an IRA, that's not going to be counted towards that community spouse resource allowance. And if you're lucky enough to live in one of the black states, then you don't have to worry about IRAs. They're an exempt asset. So lucky you guys. But generally, they do have to be, the owner does have to be taking required minimum distribution. So just be aware that we might have to count IRAs. And the income from those IRAs is countable income as well, regardless whether the IRA balance is a countable resource. Okay, so Jim, hey, you just said most things are accounted. So yeah, what are we going to do? We have people that have more than $2,000. So what folks used to do back in the Wild West was just give away all your money and then qualify for Medicaid. Well, the hammer came down on that in 1989, and then the rules have continued to develop around that. So basically the way that where we've landed today is the state Medicaid agency will look back over the last 5 years to see if there's been any gifts made. So if we're offloading assets, then they will be subject to a period of ineligibility. And we call that period of ineligibility the penalty period. And that's the period of ineligibility where the person cannot qualify for Medicaid benefits. And the way that this is determined is they look back 5 years, they see if there's been any gifts, they take the value of those gifts and they divide it by what's called the divestment penalty divisor. Again, that's going to be another one of these numbers that'll be on your desk reference guide. And the divestment penalty divisor is supposed to represent the cost of 1 month stay in a nursing home. But you can imagine that states aren't really stoked to increase that to reflect the actual cost of nursing homes in their state. So those tend to be a little bit slow. But basically, a penalty of 1 month equals the amount of the divestment penalty divisor. So you look at the divestment penalty divisor, you can give away that. If yours is like $8,000, you can give away $8,000, but it's going to cost you a month of Medicaid eligibility. Another key component to Medicaid planning is you have to be otherwise eligible when you apply. So basically what this means is you have to let Medicaid know, hey, I've gotten all the assets down below the individual resource allowance, the CSRA. I know I did some gifting. I'm going to get hit with a penalty, but otherwise I'm ready to go. So I'm otherwise eligible. I've submitted the application. Medicaid office is going to come back and say, yep, you gave away X amount of dollars. You're not eligible during this penalty period. You let the penalty period run. We're going to talk about, that's what we do in crisis planning, is calculate how we're going to pay for the nursing home during that penalty period. And then we're going to generally let Medicaid know penalty period is expired. Let the Medicaid benefits kick in and start helping pay the, you know, that roughly $10,000 a month bill at the nursing home. So we do have to take that step. It just doesn't automatically start. We have to start the penalty period by applying for Medicaid, letting them know we're otherwise eligible but for the penalty period. There are transfers that you can make, and this goes into proactive planning. So I wanted to make sure that we hit on these. Again, I could spend hours talking about each one of these. We're going to go through these pretty quick. But just be aware that you can transfer the house to certain individuals. So when you're talking about crisis or proactive planning, we want to think, can we transfer the home? If it's important, can we transfer the home to somebody and not get a penalty? And those folks are spouses living in the home. We talked about between the couple, you can make transfers before the Medicaid application. You won't get penalized. Transfer the home to a minor child or a child who's disabled under the age of 21. A child of any age of the person who or the person's spouse who's blind or certified disabled. Now, there's a Texas code, but it also cites back to the federal rules. It's a good example of a well-written Medicaid manual. There's the sibling who lives in the home that has an equity interest that was living there for a period of at least 1 year immediately before the date the person became institutionalized. And then we have the child caregiver exception, the son or daughter who lived in the home for at least 2 years before the person's institutionalization provided care that prevented institutionalization that a doctor will sign off on that kept them out of the nursing home. So just keep those in mind. Again, we could talk for hours about each one, but we can transfer the home to those folks without getting a penalty. Any other property, again, we can always transfer to the spouse or to another person for the sole benefit of the spouse. We can transfer any other property to a child who has a disability or to a sole benefit trust for that child or a sole benefit trust for any person under the age of 65 years old who's certified disabled. So this is when you're talking to your clients that come in, that want to do some crisis planning. You want to ask a couple questions around, were you planning on leaving any assets to somebody with a disability through a sole benefit trust, through a special needs trust? Was that part of your estate plan? If so, we can make those transfers now and not incur a Medicaid penalty and get those assets down. So just be aware that those transfers do exist. And obviously our favorite at Krauss, the Medicaid compliant annuity, is also an exempt transfer because it meets the requirements of the DRA from 2005 and has zero cash value. It's considered only income by the owner. And the reason why this annuity works is because it meets the five requirements of this annuity. This isn't a investment annuity. This isn't a sexy annuity. This is an annuity that's only used for Medicaid planning purposes because it has to be irrevocable, non-assignable, actuarially sound, which means that the term of the annuity has to be less than the owner's life expectancy. It has to make equal payments, so it's paying the same each month. And then you have to put the state on this annuity in the primary beneficiary position, unless it's a community spouse annuity or there's a minor disabled child that you can name as a beneficiary. Otherwise, the state is named as the beneficiary of this annuity, and that therefore they can collect any money that's left over that was spent on the person's care. So it's kind of an estate recovery move where they're going to get any money that's left in that annuity should the person pass away before the term expires. So these are very specialized annuities. Again, we have lots and lots of resources on these Medicaid compliant annuities, on attorney access. If this is your first exposure to them, please dive into those resources and you can learn lots and lots about those annuities. Another concern to think about is estate recovery. So estate recovery is what we call the program that's been designed that the federal government requires each state to have. And each state has to at least make efforts or have a program in place. Some states don't make a lot of effort to collect against the probate estate of an individual, or they can choose to expand that definition. And I want to read this through with you because it's kind of crazy. They can collect against any other real and personal property and other assets in which the individual had any legal title or interest at the time of death to the extent of such interest. Now, listen to this. Including such assets conveyed to a survivor, heir, or assigned of the deceased individual through joint tenancy in common, survivorship, life estate, living trust, or other arrangement. What this means is if your state has expanded estate recovery, is what we call it, you need to figure out a way to protect any asset. You can't just do it with deeds. You can't do it through a revocable living trust. You basically have to use what's called the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust to protect those assets from estate recovery. Irrevocable trusts are not on that list because the person had no interest in it. So that's why when you hear people talk about proactive planning, a lot of times they're talking about irrevocable trust work because it takes those assets away from estate recovery and protects them that way. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. But that's why you need to know, does your state have probate estate recovery or does it have expanded estate recovery? And then you also need to know how aggressive your state is in that. Some states, very aggressive. They're going to go after everything. If you have a transfer of property at death, they're going to reach out to those beneficiaries and say, bring us that, if sell that property and give us money because we're going to chase that. We're going to put a lien on it. You'll never be able to sell it. So estate recovery is a huge element. It's not necessarily qualification, but you have to remember that we have to think about that when we're doing our planning and helping our clients think through, what does it mean to be on Medicaid? Are we subjecting the assets in the probate estate or in the expanded estate to estate recovery? And this is where you'll hear the horror stories of, oh, they came and took my house when we passed away because we were on Medicaid. Okay, laid the foundation. You all are all expert Medicaid planners in 30 minutes. Look at 3-day course. I'm trying to do it an hour. So let's turn to proactive prep planning and what proactive planning means. So when we're talking about proactive planning, I thought the best definition was expanded estate planning, because you're really taking into account in your basic estate plan the cost of long-term care. And with that estate recovery statute in place, we know that we might have to transfer assets into an irrevocable trust, and kind of the irrevocable trust that's out there that you can get forms for from wealth counsel. And then there's other providers of those trusts like ILS, LWP. They'll see they all have the same kind of structure, kind of a term for this trust, though, that I'm familiar with. I used to work at Elder Council as the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust. You'll hear it referred to as the MAP. And basically what you're doing is you're transferring the assets that you don't want to be included in qualification, but also protect from estate recovery into that trust. So we're actually transferring assets into that trust. Then we're going to complete the traditional estate planning with everything we decided not to put in that irrevocable trust. We're going to couple that with a long-term care insurance policy, because we hopefully are talking to our clients when they're younger. They can get through underwriting. They can pay for an insurance policy. And if a long-term care need arises, we trigger those insurance benefits. So we're going to use the insurance benefits first. And then if and when those insurance benefits run out, and again, we want to be outside of that look-back period. So after at least 5 years from the transfer of the assets to the trust, we're going to apply for Medicaid benefits at that point, because we've lowered the countable assets by transferring the assets into the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, or protecting them from estate recovery as well by moving them over into that trust. But transfers to that trust would be penalized had they been made within 5 years of applying for Medicaid, because we're within that look back period. So that's kind of a real high level overview of what we're trying to accomplish with proactive planning. So again, the reason why we use these irrevocable trusts is because it's specifically designed for the purpose of protecting assets in the event of a future nursing home stay. This is not, again, not a sexy trust. This is not just an irrevocable trust you can tweak a few things and be okay with. You have to really know what needs to be limited, why it's limited, how it's limited, so that your state doesn't come in and say, well, nice try, but the grantor still has access to these assets, and so we're just going to consider them that they still own them. So it's not just an irrevocable trust that you can kind of tweak. You do have to use a specific type of irrevocable trust that's been designed for Medicaid planning to work. One thing that a question that I get quite a bit when I'm teaching about the trust is, well, Jim, wouldn't it be a lot easier just to gift it to the kids? Well, the trust accomplishes a lot of other things than just protecting things from estate recovery. If it's written properly, you can get beneficial tax treatment. You can get the step up in basis. You can maintain a lot of the tax benefits that are around the house a lot of the times, you know, those lower property taxes and things like that. You can also protect the assets from the creditors of the kids. So if you just make a transfer of those assets to the kids own them now, they're going to be subject to their creditors, their divorces, their gambling addiction, their anything else they like to do that's going to make their money go away. So if using the trust protects the assets, you know they'll be there should they need to be accessed at a later date. And then we're also creating a fiduciary duty in the trustee to protect and manage those assets. With a kid, you just give away those assets. Well, there's no fiduciary duty, and those assets can disappear when they can't be used in case of emergency. Now, remember, transfers that fund the trust are going to be subject to that penalty period if the grantor or their spouse applies for benefits within 5 years of trust funding. So this is really where the proactive part comes in, is we want to make sure that we're funding the trust and then waiting that 5 years prior to applying. And then when we go to apply for Medicaid and there's on the Medicaid application, it says, have you made any transfers within the last 60 months? We can say, nope, we made those transfers 6 years ago, not 5 years ago. It's outside the look back period and now it's not being penalized. However, if either spouse applies for benefits prior to the look back period running out, you're going to get a penalty on that. And there's no limit to how long the penalty period can be. So let's say you transferred a very valuable home, a big brokerage account. We wanted to protect those. We applied for benefits within. We forgot. The client didn't tell you they were going to apply for Medicaid benefits. They apply in 2 years. Now they have a huge penalty period. So when you're doing proactive planning, a maintenance program, having your clients come in on a regular basis can be really important so they don't just apply for Medicaid without contacting you first because they're afraid of how much it's going to cost to talk to you. So kind of boil it down, why these specific irrevocable trusts and why does it have to be so restrictive? Well, it's written into the federal statute. This is a federal statute, the language from the statute, but there was a case that I thought kind of illustrates it really well, is the trust has to pass the any circumstance test. And I thought it was really well worded by the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts in the Fournier case. In essence, the effect of the any circumstance test is that if the trustee is afforded even a peppercorn of discretion, I love it when a peppercorn shows up in that case, to make payment of principal to the applicant, or if the trust allows such payment based on certain conditions, then the entire amount that the applicant can receive under any state of affairs is the amount counted for Medicaid eligibility. So basically what this tells me is don't be cute, attorneys. Don't try to draft around these things or put a back door in them. So the grantor can go get those assets out if they need them. They won't pass the any circumstance test for Medicaid planning purposes. So again, I mentioned we're also going to try to couple this with long-term care insurance. That's your safety net. That's how we're going to get care in the home. That's how we're going to pay for it. There's really only three ways to pay for long-term care. There's out of your pocket, there's with insurance, and there's with Medicaid. And that's kind of it. So we definitely want to make sure that we're talking to our clients about long-term care insurance. A traditional long-term care insurance policy is just like any other home or automobile insurance that you have. You pick how much coverage you want. You make that premium payment each month, each year, however you have that paid out. If you have a policy in place, when you need it, you make a claim, and then the insurance company will help pay for that care. Again, you can use these outside of the nursing home, which is really important for proactive care. Most people don't want to go to the nursing home. Can we get insurance to pay for that client to live at home? The only way we can do that is by getting an insurance policy in place. They do have to go through underwriting. They do have to be healthy enough to be insured. And we do recommend getting these policies and having these conversations with folks as early as possible. So the sweet spot that the insurance industry tells us is 50 to 65. Again, we're doing proactive planning early. Enhanced estate planning. When people come in young, start talking to them about this stuff. Let's get them an insurance policy in place. We've seen a lot of attorneys bring clients to us and say, hey, can you insure these folks? They're 90 years old. They fell. They already have hip issues. But that person's not going to get insured. We need to be having these conversations with our clients when they're between the ages of 50 and 65, or they just won't be able to get this insurance. There's also something that I'm sure folks have heard of called hybrid long-term care insurance. This is basically a life insurance policy or an annuity contract that says, well, if you need long-term care while you're still alive, you can get into that death benefit and spend that down while you're alive. But if you don't need it, that's going to go to your death beneficiaries, just like any other life insurance policy. And the nice part about these is if you have a client that already has a policy, you can convert that through a 1035 exchange into a hybrid policy. So maybe you just have a life insurance policy they got when the kids were younger. It's got a good cash value on it now. Let's convert that into a hybrid policy now. And if the client needs it, well, we're going to spend down the death benefit. The kids probably don't need that. They'd much rather have their parents get the care they need outside of a nursing home. And we can use a hybrid policy in that scenario. And again, we could talk hours about these policies, but we do have a lot of resources around annuities, long-term care insurance, all these strategies on attorney access. Okay. 40 minutes in, we get to our first case study. So let's look at proactive planning case study. I wrote this one, so bear with me. I'm not the greatest case study writer in the world. And with proactive planning, it's really going to vary based on your client's goals. And that's what's nice about proactive planning is when you're doing proactive planning, you're giving your clients options. With crisis planning, there's kind of one option. We got to get the Medicaid annuity in place, do some spend downs, and hope for the best. But with proactive planning, their clients can really dictate where they're going to get their care, who's going to give that care, and how they're going to pay for it. So let's look at Jerry's a single widower. He's 65, and he's in good health. He was a primary caregiver for his parents and understand the burden placed on caregivers. He doesn't want his kids to have to do that for him. So common scenario, great client for proactive planning, understands the value of this types of planning. He lives close to his kids and enjoys spending time with them and their families. He lives a very active life and wants to continue to enjoy it, but also wants to have a plan so doesn't become a burden on his kids. I love Jerry, forward thinker, thinking through things. What he's concerned about is the home he lives in has been in the family for multiple generations, and it's important to protect it from creditors. So we're thinking, all right, Jerry, you want to make sure that you have a caregiver. We want to protect the home, but we live in a state that has expanded their Medicaid estate recovery program, and they're aggressive in collection. So we have a lot of things kind of going through our head. What can we do to help Jerry out? We have kind of the case facts here. We'll look at it from a high level. He's 65. He's got great health. He's active. We know that. He's 65. He's within our sweet range for those insurance policies, 50 to 65. And he has monthly income. This is one of the keys for proactive planning is determining how much does Jerry need to live off of each month, because that's going to help us determine what are we going to move into the irrevocable trust, because remember, we can't even have a peppercorn of benefit coming out of that trust back to Jerry. You can't have an income right, but we can't have him getting into that principal. So we need Jerry goals here, you know, list them out. What does Jerry want and what can we do as an attorney to accomplish Jerry's goals? We have Jerry's goals are to live comfortably and active, enjoy time with his kids and his loved ones, avoid having his kids be primary caregiver, protect the home so it can stay in the family, and then leave some money for his kids. So let's look at his assets. We have a home valued at $600,000. We have a checking account at $100,000, a savings account at $300,000, brokerage account at $200,000, and a life insurance policy with a cash value of $400,000. So again, this is a proactive planning solution. First thing we're going to think about is let's protect the home. How are we going to do that? We're going to use a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust. So we're going to transfer the home and his brokerage account worth $200,000. We're going to change the ownership of those to the trustee of a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust. If we wait 5 years, that's not going to be a penalized transfer. The home's now protected from estate recovery should the insurance benefits run out and he has to go on Medicaid. But we're going to maintain that right to live in that house through the trust, through a right of occupancy, or we could do a lease with the trustee that just renews every year, and Jerry can continue to live in that home. We have not affected his life in any way, shape, or form by making this transfer, other than he's not the owner of the home anymore, the trustee is, and he can't play with that brokerage account. He's going to have his trustee do that. Hopefully he has a trusted person that he can name to do that. And then what we're going to do is look at that life insurance policy. It has a $400,000 cash value. Let's convert that into a life insurance policy with a high, with a long-term care rider or benefit on it through a 1035 exchange. And now we've created insurance money that can pay for the home health care, assisted living, or nursing home should he need it. So we've transferred and protected $800,000 to the house, and we're $800,000 worth of assets into a Medicaid asset protection trust. We've created a hybrid life insurance policy that's going to pay out over $400,000 for benefits for his care should he need it. That was one of his goals, was to make sure his kids didn't have to be a caregiver. And then we have left him $400,000 outside of those plans so he can continue to live an active and comfortable lifestyle. Plus, he's getting $5,000 a month in pension and Social Security. So we've been able to do everything that Jerry wanted us to do. And should his long-term care policy be exhausted, he can then do crisis planning with those funds that we left outside of the trust. But we protected the home and the brokerage account without incurring a penalty, and so he can leave a legacy for his children. So Jerry came in with his goal, and you just accomplished them with proactive planning. So hopefully that makes sense. Again, the solution is going to change quite a bit with proactive planning rather than crisis planning. But hopefully that opens your eyes to the power of using a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, using insurance money to help pay for that care, and then also the protections that affords from qualification and also estate recovery. So when you're designing the trust, there are going to be a lot of different considerations. Do we have income coming back to the grantor? Who's going to be the lifetime beneficiaries on that trust? And how are we going to design it so that Jerry has a right to live in the home, either through a right of occupancy or a lease agreement with the trustee outside of the trust agreement? But again, we protected all the assets he wanted. We used a trust instead of gifting the assets for tax benefits purposes, as well as protecting them from creditors. And if he needs to qualify for Medicaid, we got his assets down. We're going to wait the 5 years. We'll be able to protect that $800,000 worth of assets to go to his kids without having to impact his Medicaid qualification. So kind of a great result for Jerry in this case. Okay. Proactive planning. Give your clients options. They can pick where they want to stay. They can pick what their plan is. They can move things around so long as they wait 5 years and apply for Medicaid. Crisis planning, the house is on fire. We got to put this baby out as quickly as we can. This is when the client walks in the door. They're already in the nursing home or going into the nursing home like tomorrow. They have too many assets to qualify for Medicaid, but they want to qualify for Medicaid to get some help with that $10,000 a month bill. So the first thing that you want to do is look, how are we going to spend down assets to get underneath that individual resource allowance and the CSRA? So people always ask, they say, Jim, I want a checklist. And I say, well, checklists can't happen because each state is different and there's a lot of variables. This is as close as I'm ever going to give you to a checklist, is we're going to transfer assets. We're going to look at those exempt transfers if the facts allow. Can we give the house to a caregiver child, to a sibling with an equity interest, or other transfers to special needs folks through sole benefit trust? Can we purchase or improve those exempt assets? Those assets don't count. Maybe we have some, you know, an old roof on the house that would bend down $20,000. We get below the amounts. Now we're good to go and we didn't have to do any sort of other spend down. Can we pay off debt? You can always pay off debt. You can always buy things. Do we have funeral plans in place? Can we purchase a funeral expense trust? And then once we've gone through kind of this process, does purchasing a Medicaid compliant annuity make sense? So we're kind of going to divide the two strategies for crisis planning into the strategy for a married couple and single folks. So with the married couple, it's pretty straightforward. What most attorneys elect to do for their clients is they'll take any assets above the community spouse resource allowance and fund them into an annuity, a Medicaid compliant annuity for that community spouse. Because remember, one of our main rules is the community spouse can have income. There's no ceiling on that. So after purchasing the Medicaid compliant annuity, what the Medicaid compliant annuity does is it takes those assets that were keeping them from being qualified and immediately turns them into an income stream for the community spouse, which allows the institutionalized spouse to immediately apply and qualify for benefits while we've increased the income for the community spouse. Pretty straightforward and simple. Great result. Now for the single person, it's a little bit more confusing because we don't have a community spouse to purchase that annuity. So what we'll do here is we'll do what's called a gift and annuity plan. And again, we have lots and lots of webinars on these, so I'm not going to get too heavy into the details. But basically what the client does is they use those gifting rules to their advantage by intentionally divesting about half of their assets and forcing a penalty period. And then whatever assets are remaining after that, they'll use those to purchase a Medicaid-compliant annuity that's going to generate the income to pay through the penalty period. And the economic benefit here lies in that gift. So we made a gift generally to a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust or a kid at that point. That's what we saved the family. We're going to use the rest of the money to purchase the annuity and pay income so that they can live in the nursing home and privately pay their bill until the penalty period expires. Okay, let's look at a couple cases very quickly here. Again, we have PDFs of these in the materials in the Dropbox link under the chat. We have Gerald, who's 81. He recently entered a nursing home that costs $9,000 per month. His wife, Angela, who's 80, is concerned about losing their life savings and paying for Gerald's care, so they call a local elder law attorney for some help. We have Gerald's income at $2,800, Angela's income at $2,500. Their total countable assets are $395,000. We know Gerald's cost of care every month is costing $9,000. If they don't do anything, that $395,000 is going to be gone as little as 44 months. So in 44 months, their entire life savings that they saved their whole life to use will be gone at the nursing home. And guess what? Angela's going to be home broke. And so because we had to go to the nursing home, this is the exact worst thing that could happen to this couple. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to have Angela purchase the Medicaid-compliant annuity as the community spouse to accelerate Gerald's eligibility for Medicaid. And so what we've done here is we've immediately eliminated their countable assets that was keeping Gerald from qualifying for Medicaid, and we've increased her income through that annuity. So let's see how these numbers work out. So we have Angela. She's able to keep the family home because it's an exempt asset, car, furniture, personal property. And remember, she still has a community spouse resource allowance of $157,920. We're just going to have her keep 155 because we don't want her too close to the edge of eligibility. So we're going to have Gerald keeping his 2,000 as the individual resource allowance. So we're going to figure out the spend down amount by taking the total countable assets. We're going to subtract out Angela's allowance of 155, Gerald's allowance of 2,000, and we get a total spend down amount of $238,000. So that is our total spend down amount that we have to figure out what to do with. So remember, we have to have an annuity that is less than Angela's life expectancy. So we get out our life expectancy table. We look at her age. It tells us that her life expectancy is 8.9 years or 113 months. So the annuity term just has to be shorter than 113 months. So what we can do with the community spouse allowance is us and Angela can sit down and figure out, do we want to use a longer term? Is she in good health? Does she have family history of longevity? Or do we use a shorter term? Maybe there's questionable health. We want to get that money back to Angela as quickly as possible because, remember, we have to name the Medicaid agency as a beneficiary on this annuity. So the goal is to choose a term that you and the client are comfortable with. So in this case, her attorney opts for a 48-month term. With this annuity, Angela is the owner and payee of the MCA. The primary beneficiary is the state agency to the extent of benefits paid on Gerald's behalf, and the contingent beneficiary is the couple's children. So it's a single premium of $238,000 over 48 months. So the monthly payout to Angela is going to be $4,980 as monthly payout. So again, she's the owner. Primary beneficiary is the state Medicaid agency. She just needs to live 48 months, and then that annuity will have expired, and all that money will come back to Angela. Remember, once we purchased the annuity, now we're qualified, we're going to apply for Medicaid, and Angela's income went from $2,500 to $4,980. So her total income went from $2,500 to $7,480 per month. And Gerald, we need to know what he's going to be paying at the nursing home. If Gerald's income is $2,800, his personal needs allowance is $50, so $2,750, and basically all of Gerald's income minus $50 is going to go to the nursing home. We didn't calculate in any sort of health insurance deduction from there as well. So here we have Gerald getting immediate Medicaid eligibility, and the couple is saving $6,250 a month from what they originally came in paying $9,000, and then we've increased Angela's income to $7,480, which is way more than she would have ever got through amendment diversion. So again, this is, I had an attorney come up to me at a conference and I was teaching the strategy. She says, that's not an annuity, that's magic. And it really is. We have a married couple case and we can come in and the facts are that straightforward and we can get the community spouse's income up and immediate eligibility for the institutionalized person. It really is kind of like magic, and your clients are going to be so relieved to know that they're not going to leave, in our case there, Angela broke and destitute because all the money went to Gerald's care. Okay, so the single person gifted annuity does involve a little bit more math, and I'm going to try to do this one in the 7 minutes we have left, so bear with me. And again, we have lots and lots of resources on attorney access, but we do want to go through this case study. So we have Jules is a single woman, 85 years old, who's been diagnosed with dementia and enters a nursing home. Her family decides to move her into a nursing home that costs $9,600 per month, and she has countable assets preventing her from qualifying for Medicaid benefits. So here, the key numbers are that state divestment penalty divisor of $8,450. Her monthly income is $2,350. We have total countable assets of $157,000. So she's way over the individual resource allowance. So if she does nothing and she's spending $9,600 per month, geez, she lost all of her money in 16 months. Think about that. You work your whole life, you go to nursing home, everything gone in 16 months. So what we're going to do to Jules, we're going to say, hey, let's do a gift and annuity strategy. We're going to be able to preserve about half of those assets for your kids so you can make a gift to your kids and still get the care you need. So the first thing we have to do for Jules is figure out what the spend down amount is, just like we did in our married couple case. So we take the total countable assets, we subtract out the individual resource allowance in the state is still $2,000. So our spend down amount is $155,000. So we have to calculate the burn rate. This is how much money this plan is going to cost Jules each month. So we have Jules' cost of care is $9,600. We have her income, which is going to go to the nursing home to pay for her care, is $2,350. So we have a shortfall each month of $7,250. You can pay, well, that's what Jules would be spending out of pocket that she's missing between her income and her cost of care each month of $7,250. So we have to come up with that amount each month. And then we're going to calculate in and add in the divestment penalty divisor of $8,450, because remember that penalty divestment divisor represents 1 month of penalty for a gift. We're going to, for every $8,450 that we're going to give away, we're going to have a 1 month penalty. So for each month, Jules is going to burn through $15,700 of her money for each month of the plan. So the next thing we're going to do is we're going to take our burn rate and we're going to divide it to figure out what is the length of the plan. So here we take our spend down amount was $155,000. Our burn rate is $15,700. We're going to divide those and we get a length of the plan, 9.87 months. We're going to round that up to 10 months. So now that we know that the length of the plan is 10 months, we want to figure out how much can we gift away. So the length of the plan is 10 months. We're going to times that by the divestment penalty divisor. We get $84,500. So that is the gift amount. This is the benefit that Jules got from coming to your office and paying you for this plan. She got her family $84,000. You can't tell me there's a return on investment for an attorney that's better than $84,000 on a retainer. So this is really where the value comes in crisis planning when you're dealing with a single person. And you really want to highlight that gift amount as the ROI on their investment in working with you. And so we're going to gift away the $84,500. That leaves Jules with $70,500, and we're going to purchase the Medicaid-compliant annuity with that. So we're going to take the $70,000. We're going to have an annuity turnover of 10 months. That's going to have a monthly payout of over $7,000. Jules is going to be the owner of that annuity primary beneficiary is going to be the state Medicaid agency. And if there's any money left, then the secondary beneficiary will be her children. Again, remember, we have to apply for Medicaid after we make the gift and we purchase the annuity. Jules is considered otherwise eligible for benefits. We're going to let Medicaid know. We're going to submit the application. We're going to say, we made these transfers. We're going to let Medicaid know all about it because we're complying with all the rules. And then her penalty period is going to start. So during that 10 months, she's going to use her income and the income created from the Medicaid compliant annuity to pay for the nursing home bill. So you can see original income was $2,350. The Medicaid compliant annuity brings her income up to $9,405. Now, Jim, you're probably saying, well, her bill was $9,600 each month. There will be a shortfall, and we did that on purpose because we don't want to get too close to the edge and her income is greater than the private pay rate. Then she wouldn't no longer be eligible for Medicaid benefits. So we have to figure out where to come up with the $195. We just gifted the kids $84,000. Hopefully one of them is willing to step up and pay that. So the economic results of the gift and annuity strategy is after the 10-month penalty period, Jules' monthly income goes back to the $2,350. Let's say she gets to keep the $50 in her personal needs allowance. So her monthly Medicaid copay now is $2,300. She gifted $84,500 to her children, which is over 50% of her spend down amount. So what we've done here is we've gifted away over $84,000 and allowed her to get on Medicaid within 10 months to help pay for that bill. So that is crisis planning with a gift and annuity strategy. Again, we have lots and lots of resources around these strategies and the nuances of them. And somehow you all just watched me go through 71 slides in 59 minutes. So let me turn and see what questions we have real quickly. If I haven't been able to answer those or they weren't answered already, I will see what we can do here. I just have to figure out where they are. Bear with me. Okay. Copy the slides. Those are in the chat. How do these rules differ for community Medicaid? When people are talking about community Medicaid, that is a different program. Those programs are very, very state to state. That's where a lot of the changes that are coming into play at the beginning of 2027 for things like work requirements, all sorts of other things that I won't get into, are going to be part of that program. Those are community Medicaid. That's insurance for folks that don't make a certain amount of income. So this is a completely different part of the Medicaid program. Medicaid is a huge program. We refer to this as long-term care Medicaid. So the community Medicaid rules are completely separate and are very focused on income, is my understanding. I actually don't know a whole lot about qualifying for community Medicaid. What is it too old to do proactive planning when your clients are sick? So with proactive planning, what we're really looking for is a five-year runway. Otherwise, you have to blow up the plan and try to figure it out. So you want to have at least 5 years of good health. Is there a right of occupancy? How is the mortgage paid? All that's going to be really state specific and based on what program or forms you're using. So that's kind of hard for me to answer. And you guys are asking great questions, but now I can't see the ones I've already answered. Materials are in the chat. 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 How do community property laws impact proactive and crisis planning? Generally, Medicaid doesn't care about community property. They just aren't that interested in trying to figure that out. Again, kind of that main rule for spouses is it's owned as one unit because all the assets are counted as one unit, irregardless of prenups, postnups, how things are titled. They'll just count it all in one bucket. Let's see. If both spouses are applying for benefit, is there a CSRI equivalent? Yeah, you'll see on your desk reference guide, it'll have a number. I think spouses, CSRI, or both spouses number assets, usually 3,000. So if you see that number on there, that's generally what it is. Yep. All the slides are in the chat. But regarding the primary beneficiary of the MCA being, how would Medicaid pay out during the life of the annuity? The annuity covers the penalty period. So yeah, that's a really good question and very smart, Cassandra. If you're in the penalty period and the person passes away and they haven't received Medicaid benefits in the past, the state wouldn't have a claim. So what would happen then is the insurance company would send a notice to the state that says, hey, this person has passed away. Do you have a Medicaid claim against this annuity? if they haven't received Medicaid benefits in the past, the state's going to say nope, and then those assets would go to the secondary beneficiary because they haven't already qualified for Medicaid. Good eye. I really like that. That was good. Found 4 case studies. Yep, there's lots of case studies in Attorney Axos. Please get in there. Where is the chat? Okay. All right. So if you couldn't find the materials, they will be available in an email that will come out. If you can't find the chat, they will be in an email that will come out with a recording of this. And again, please use that Attorney Axos, all the materials and things we put on there. If you do have a case like this and you want to talk to one of our planners, please click on that link, crossfinancial.com/discovery. This is where our professionals can walk you through maybe a client's case facts and be able to get those. So please feel free to use our staff when you have a case. We can walk through the case facts with you. There's no charge until you purchase an annuity, your client purchases an annuity. We can always help you kind of work through that and figure that out. So we're here to help you. If you have a case like any of these that came up, again, we also provide long-term care insurance. If you're doing more of the proactive planning, we do have a process to get your clients' quotes. If you want to be involved in that process, we can have, our insurance agents work directly through you. Or if you just want to make the referral, you can make that referral to us, and then we will contact the client directly. If you want to get licensed and be able to share in a commission from long-term care insurance sales through your office, we can also do it that way. So we're here to help. Just let us know if we can be of service to you all. So please fill out the survey. That's how you're going to get your CLE credit. And I'll get out of here so you guys can fill that out. And again, we'll send out the materials and fill out that survey. And thank you guys so much, more importantly, for having the interest in this type of planning, being able to help those clients, and really being a big asset in your community for folks that are really facing financial disaster.
Thank you again, Jim, for your great presentation. And thank you to everyone for joining us today for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon, everyone.